You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. The rise of horror films in the 21st century may come as no surprise to those of us who got bit by the bug at an early age. But for anyone taking their tentative first steps into this genre, it can be a daunting prospect to know where on earth they should start. Thankfully for us, horror addict Emily C. Hughes has released Horror for Weenies, a fantastic collection of must-see films that newbies or experienced lovers of horror will find something to discover. But before we join Emily, don't forget, of course, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes. And thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support the show. You can find Mysteries and Monsters across most social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. And you can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news and episodes. Our exclusive merchandise site is available through TeePublic, and you can find the link for that in the show notes as always. Our intro and outro music are performed by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Bestall for his marvellous artwork, and the show is produced by Brennan Stall of the Ghost Story Guys. Turn on the lights, grab some snacks, and let's join Emily C. Hughes to discover Horror for Weenies. For many of us horror lovers, we simply love some of our favourites, like a well-polished skull. Yet for others, dipping a toe into the genre can be quite a daunting approach. Where do they start? What could they discover? Where is it that they should begin? Thankfully, Emily C. Hughes has released her first book, Horror for Weenies, to help these newbies join our cult. Emily, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you so much for having me, Paul. I am delighted to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. I love books like this because it makes me realize that sometimes I'm too precious about some of my favorite films. And not everybody wants to see zombies tearing through towns and cities across the world over a family dinner sometimes, Emily. But you are somebody who is what one would could describe as an uber horror lover, really. This is your... Your meat and drink, is it not?
It is, and it wasn't always, but it is now. Now, you know, it's, horror is not all of my pop culture consumption, but it is a significant portion.
Do you think it's easier to feed these addictions in this modern era? Because I think the thing we, certain people of a certain vintage, I say, speaking about myself rather badly there, Emily, is that... I'm the chap that kind of grew up through that great era of the video store with hundreds and hundreds of strange looking titles staring down at me. And so I feel my education into the modern horror started probably quite similarly to a lot of people, I think, in that era.
Yeah, I was growing up at the tail end of the video store era. You know, I still have plenty of memories of browsing a Blockbuster and picking out, you know, what we wanted to rent that weekend. But I think it's kind of a double-edged sword living in the media landscape that we live in now. On the one hand, you have access to movies, you know, at your fingertips that would have been impossible for you to find, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, including movies from all over the world, including, you know, weirdo out of, you know, kind of out of circulation stuff.
Yes.
But it does lose, I mean, well, the drawbacks are, A, you are at the mercy of what the companies that own the streaming services, you know, want to do, which is a topic I could bang on about for hours, quite frankly.
Yes.
But it also, you lose some of that magic of discovery. There was an era where the horror movie you started with was the one that your, you know, your best friend's older sister or older brother happened to have left on the shelf, and you know, it's after midnight and you're having a sleepover and you think you're really getting away with something by sticking that VHS into the video player. And there, that doesn't happen so much anymore. And I think there's a little bit of lost magic there. Not that it's bad to have broader access, but I do think that, you know, there's that when you have all of these options, deciding what to watch becomes much harder. And there's this kind of pressure of like, okay, well, if I want to get into a genre that I don't know, I have to do it the right way. And I have to start with this movie. And there's that, it kind of takes away from the time that you could just be spending watching the movies. So there's, you know, as with so many things, there are pluses and minuses.
Well, it's interesting you touch on that point, because I think one of the things that's been quite surprising for me is obviously the recent release of the 28 Years Later trailer, which has kind of just blown up. I'm surprised in two aspects of it. Firstly, I didn't realize those films were as popular as they clearly seem to be. But then the second thing about it was loads of people are now saying, well, I can't watch the other two because they're not on streaming, which is a bit odd because I've got both of obviously 28 days and 28 weeks. But it shows that there is a real appetite for some of these titles, because I think it's what, 15 years since 28 Weeks Later. But as you mentioned there about streaming, the fact that neither of those two films are available, that they're both available here in the UK, outside of the UK, they're not available. And I just find that amazing that you have companies who can make a decision about such well-loved films being available for people to get, and they're not even available to buy in most places. And second-hand copies are going for stupid prices. Do you think this is, I mean, for me, it's always been an argument. I'm a big believer in physical media.
A million percent. Yeah. Huge same. I actually, my husband has been on this train since, I mean, we've been together 10 years, and pretty much ever since I met him, he's like, no, physical media, owned media. And I always thought he was kind of like, you know, being a little over the top about it. No, he was completely right. And I'll say that to his face. No, I miss having, you know, the stack of DVDs and the storage wallet that you'd kind of flip through with those weird little plastic sleeves.
Yes.
But I did learn actually just, well, I learned two interesting things yesterday. The first of which is that the 28 Years Later trailer is now apparently the second most watched horror trailer of all time.
Yeah.
And the other is that here in the States, 28 Days Later has in fact just made it to streaming finally. I think they realized they were leaving money on the table. Can't have that.
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, before we dive into the book, staying with 28 Days, I think the thing for me that makes it so loved by people is, I think because of when it came out, it seemed to completely revitalize, despite what Danny Boyle may say about the protagonists in that particular film. It, for me, it completely revitalized the zombie movie, because it had completely seemed to have dropped off the radar. As someone who adores the Romero films, I love the first two Return of the Living Dead for different reasons, even though they're essentially the first films remade again, and The Evil Dead. By the time you get to sort of the mid-90s, they've really fallen away. They're just not cool. Obviously now, 20, 25 years later, you've got zombies with primetime shows, you've got rom-com zombies, you've got some of the best zombie books in fiction have been released this century. It's remarkable how you can, for me anyway, Emily, how you can sort of say from that point on, zombies came cool again.
Yeah, and it was kind of a magical moment of the combination of 28 Days Later and the release of the video game Resident Evil.
Yes.
Those happened right around the same time, and they kind of spurred this reanimation, for lack of a better word. I had to, sorry. But I totally agree with you, because, you know, Night of the Living Dead and the subsequent Romero movies, obviously titanically important. But there was this gradual slide, especially as horror in general in the 90s became more of a, okay, we're doing sequels, we're doing endless franchise, you know, extensions, we're doing this kind of weird, winky comic horror because, you know, Scream was the prior, you know, big, huge hit. And zombies had gotten kind of goofy.
Mm.
And I think making them scary again was really the key there, because, you know, in the endless kind of nerd debate over fast versus slow zombies, you know, slow zombies, the scariness is there, but it's less urgent, right? And so making them fast, and one of the best things Danny Boyle did in that film was to cast athletes and gymnasts yes. as the zombies, because they had that physicality and they had that raw power and speed. And it's really effective when you go back and watch the movie knowing that, and you see the way they move and you go, yeah, no, that is, you can't really buy that. You can't buy that with effects, right? You can't do that with digital alteration.
Absolutely. And obviously you've got Cillian Murphy just acting his face off throughout that film. Mm-hmm. And it's also one of those, because it's got that really dark undercurrent of people being absolute shits as well. And some of them get their comeuppance, thankfully. You know, they'll be dropping spoilers throughout this episode. And I'm sorry, if you haven't seen something that's 25 years old, it's hard lines. I apologize right. now. But I am still very surprised how much love has been shown to that film in the last 10 days since the new trailer dropped. Do you think it's one of those that it's been such an influential film without really getting the kudos it deserves, and it's now the ground base, the people that love these films, that love these subjects, that have just once again risen up and made the studio take notice and go, actually, yeah, we've not treated this franchise very well.
Well, I think a lot of it is really down to the continued success of both Danny Boyle and Alex Garland.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, if neither of them had wanted to be involved with, you know, a third installment, or as it's going to be, a new trilogy, actually,
yes.
Then I don't think it ever would have happened. I think studios, you know, I can see an alternate reality in which some studio head went, oh, you know what we should do? We should reboot 28 Days Later, which I now that I've said, I wish I hadn't said that out loud, actually, I've spoken it into reality.
It's your fault now, Emily.
Oh, blame me. Yeah, no, I fully take responsibility for that. But I do think that the fact that there is this lasting interest in this franchise has a lot to do with just how scary it was, and how scary it was in this incredibly guerrilla way, right? Mm. Like this guerrilla style of filmmaking and this real, you know, use what's at hand style, you know, the using the handheld camcorder, and you watch it now and you're like, God, the video quality is shit. I love it. So I think there's, you know, and I think it's those of us who were kind of right at, I mean, I'm showing my age here, but I think I was 15 or 16 when the first movie came out. And so that was just exactly the right moment for me. And zombies are also just a perennial favorite of mine. They're kind of my pet favorite monster. So for me, this was always going to be like, you know, I'm there day one. I'm there at the earliest showing.
I think it's also good as well, like you say, because as I was alluding to, Return of the Living Dead parts 1 and 2, I love. And they're films that I always try to introduce people. I've got friends who aren't into horror into the Return of the Living Dead, the first two, just because how silly they are and some of the stupid lines, like when they're talking about all skeletons come from India, everybody knows that. And just really random things that are in it. But obviously it was written by Dan O'Bannon, who obviously cut his chops writing the screenplay for Alien. He was horror royalty, really. And then with the sequel being similar but slightly more, I suppose, sort of had the edge taken off, and it's not as full on as the first one, but it's still got its moments, really. I'm still surprised, ironically, that is being resurrected, because there was a trailer appeared, I think, in the last 3 or 4 days from a studio saying that they're bringing them back.
Yeah, that I haven't delved into that too much. I'm as might not surprise you given what I just said, but I am not a big fan of the endless reboot culture. You know, if you want to make a sequel, fine, I can live with that. We've been doing that as long as there have been movies.
Mm.
But we don't need endless new iterations on the same cultural properties over and over. You know, I don't think, you know, it's one thing when it's Scream and it's okay, we're, you know, 7 movies into this franchise. You know, maybe we want to drop the age on the main characters a little bit. you know, I get that, but I don't, I think audiences are smarter than studios give them credit for in general. And we don't just want regurgitated stories that we've seen 25 times before. I don't know. This is a source of endless frustration for me.
Well, yeah, because it is. I think this is one of the things. Sometimes I think studios treat the horror audience as if they're idiots, whereas the directors often will understand that the audience that watch horror films are usually a bit more switched on. They're usually more culturally aware and probably more emotionally sensitive than your average studio audience. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when you get directors like Jordan Peele or writers like Dan O'Bannon, George Romero, who threw his hat at doing everything near enough, the audience responds because they realise they're being treated as intellectuals. They're not being treated mm-hmm. just as bums on seats.
Right. You feel seen by yes. the direct, for lack of a better term. It's like, oh, I feel recognised and not pandered to.
Mm. I mean, Spielberg's a prime example of that. When you look at some of his early films, he didn't think that his audience needed everything spoon-feeding to them. You know, we don't get a great big introduction about sharks and why they eat people, or right. or why what UFOs are and why they're flying around bothering people in this particular state for whatever reason, and trying to pull them all towards Devil's Mountain. He just basically said, well, this is an incredible story that we're about to share together. And yeah. we all join in and follow the story as it takes us. And so when you look at things like that, I mean, obviously one of the first ones you cover in the book is Romero's Night of the Living Dead, which I think some people, not that I think they've got blasé to it, Emily, I think some people don't understand the cultural impact of that film, even into the modern era. I mean, it's, what, 1968, so it's over 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The ending still makes me angry because
oh, enraging. Yeah.
Not because of how I feel about the film or I'm angry about what Romero does. I'm angry because I understand exactly what's going on at that precise moment. And seeing our hero get to that point and surviving all this horror that's been thrown at him, like killer children, for God's sake, you've got to, You're completely empathizing with this character, which I think for a lot of people in that era was a very unusual aspect for them, that they began to empathize with a black main character.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was the first black lead in horror, obviously, you know, who wasn't a token or a villain or just an outright racist caricature. And, you know, there's that sort of like famous, long, often repeated anecdote that Romero, you know, didn't change any of the dialogue once he had cast Dwayne Jones. He just was like, well, you know, I cast you because you're the best person for this role. Here it is. I'm not going to change anything, which is exactly kind of how that should be handled. But obviously the shading of the connotations that are lent to the movie overall by Ben's race, the fact that he strikes Barbara, and it's not because he's evil or bad, it's because she's hysterical and he needs to be able to focus on protecting them. But a black man striking a white woman on screen and having it not be like a villainous move was just unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's something I kind of not struggled with, but something I found myself having to grapple with over and over and over as I was writing, was how to keep saying in different ways, I know this doesn't seem like a big deal now, but at the time it was a huge deal. from you know, big important things like, for instance, police violence against black people, to sillier things like, you know, the toilet flushing in Psycho being the first time that was like, yes. you know, focused in on camera in a commercial film.
Yes.
I mean, because I think, you know, if you grow up watching, you know, let's say somebody else my age, someone in their late 30s who started watching horror movies at the earliest in the late 90s, you don't have any of that sort of cultural context for what came before. You just see the stuff that's responding to it. And so when you go back, and let's say you've watched is 28 Days Later and The Walking Dead, if you go back and watch Night of the Living Dead, you know, the scares are not going to hit the same. No, you know, it's not as scary because what what scares us changes over time. And we also have sort of different levels of exposure to gore and extreme violence on screen than people in the 60s would have. But I like to point out that, you know, if you go back and you do watch these older movies, you're going to understand a whole bunch of references and a whole bunch of, you know, I mean, yeah, in jokes, fine, you know, references to specific characters or specific lines, but also just cinematic resonances, right? This is shot this way because Alfred Hitchcock shot it this way. This is, you know, the whole zombies eating people, that was pretty original to Romero. You know, before that, the figure of the zombie in American pop culture was usually just a lazy racist stereotype for stories about Haiti.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you saw some of the studios dally with that sort of theme in the 40s. Bela Lugosi is, I'm trying to remember what that one's called.
Oh, White Zombie. Is
White Zombie, yeah. Yes, which is a bit...
yeah.
Yeah, but I think Bela was just picking films to keep him busy, I think, at that particular period, because he made some pretty rum choices, and unfortunately I've seen most of them. but hey, that's the price we pay. And so, like you say, I think sometimes we overlook the importance of what went on at that period, because I know everybody always talks about cinema sort of changing at the end of the 60s, when the laws became a little bit less restrictive and studios suddenly started to push the boundaries. And I think it's very surprising sometimes that you seem to have like an explosion of things going off at the same time, like fireworks of ideas, Emily, where you've got three or four directors or screenwriters who are all in different places around the world, who all seem to suddenly catch the zeitgeist, because not only have you got Night of the Living Dead coming out, we get Rosemary's Baby, which is still probably one of those films that I forget how much it chills me,
mm-hmm.
when essentially it on the surface, it doesn't seem to be that frightening. But I think it's that undercurrent of, I'm the only person here who isn't mad, basically. Mm-hmm. And or have I gone mad and everybody else is fine? Or are they all mad and I'm fine and I don't know what's happening? And I think it's one of those films where you suddenly realise halfway through that, oh dear, she's right.
Yep. Yeah, that progressive isolation is so effective. I'm in my, you know, humble opinion, that is as close to a perfect film as I think we really get as a society.
Yes. I mean, it is. And it's punctuated with shocking moments throughout, mm-hmm. which is one of those sometimes you can forget aspects of films, whether your mind just kind of skips it or you try not to remember it being as gut-punching as it turns out to be. There are several films where this happens, where you hear people talk about them and you think, have you actually seen this film properly? Because the amount of people who tell me they love Saturday Night Fever, and I think, I don't think you remember that film as well as you think you do.
Right, that's a very depressing movie.
It's dark as hell. It's not a nice film, and I think everybody remembers 10 Minutes of Dancing and mm-hmm. the soundtrack, and they forget all the horrible social crap that's going on all around it, and the misogyny and the racism and the just the squalor of it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I mean, it's a selective memory, is, you know, human nature, I think. But no, it's true, when you haven't seen something in a while, the bits that stand out to you are not always the representative bits.
When you look at that period of the 60s, because obviously the first film you touch on is Psycho, which is one of those strange moments in Hitchcock's career, because he did it in the 40s with Rebecca. It's very rare that you get a successful director buying a blockbuster novel that's just come out. Usually the book's been out several years and they to and fro about the rights. But Hitchcock did it twice, because Rebecca is also a very strange sort of supernatural film. Whilst it's not on the same level as Psycho, there's still a lot of mystery and strangeness about it. He was very good at picking these gems out that you wouldn't expect from a director who, the rest of his catalogue is essentially tense thrillers, whereas these two are, essentially, they are horror films of varying nature.
Yeah. And then you have The Birds, which to my mind is, you know, objectively horror. You know, and that horror thriller designation is always very slippery anyway, but... yeah, I think that's a testament. I mean, I you know, he was famously a very difficult man, but I think there's no doubt that he had the self-confidence to know what his vision was and to chase it and make it happen no matter what. And there, you know, there are lots of great anecdotes about him sort of messing with the censors when, you know, the production code was still in effect. You know, he would just lie to them and tell them he'd edited something out, and then he'd show it to them again the same as it was the first time, and they'd go, oh yeah, great. Or he'd distract them at a particular moment in the screening.
Yes. Look at this.
Right. Oh, look over there.
Popcorn.
Right. No, you didn't just see her boob. It's fine.
It's a trick in the light.
Yes. But yeah, I mean, just a remarkable kind of economy of storytelling in that movie. And then when you start reading about it, all of the work that he did, you know, not letting the stars do interviews or, you know, promotional, you know, stuff about the movie because he didn't want them to give anything away. He tried to get theaters to not allow people to come in midway through the screening because, I mean, you know, the death of Marion Crane happens not quite halfway through the movie. Mm. And it was much more common at the time for people to just kind of wander into whatever movie was playing, you know, partway through. He bought up as many copies of Robert Bloch's novel as he could because he didn't want people to read it and then spoil themselves for the film. It's just really like things that are kind of monomaniacal, of course, but like kind of unthinkable today.
Yes. it is surprising occasionally that you get films that come out in the modern era where you basically have to dance or just not go online for a week until you see it these days, even in the most strangest of places. I remember several years ago, I was on Facebook and I was reading a post on the NFL's site and they were talking about the dates for the new season coming up. And somebody had gone on this conversation posting spoilers about Avengers Endgame all over it.
God.
And I was like, what on earth is going on here? Why would someone go out of their way? It had nothing to do with what was going on in this conversation. And it was everywhere. And it like, no. So that was it. Right. I've had 3 minutes on the internet and it's nearly ruined my week. So no, we're not doing this. And so you think you hear that and you think that it would be physically impossible. Even these days, you get certain films that come out and there's a twist or a trick or two in it. I think if you go looking for it, you can find it. But it doesn't seem to be as bad as I suspect some people imagine it to be, Emily. I think if you go looking for it, you'll find it very easily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's true. I think, you know, I have also found spoilers in just the weirdest places. You know, sometimes I'll open my phone and, you know, my browser will be like, oh, you have shown interest in these topics. Would you like to?
Here's
the ending of that new. I can't even remember. I think that it spoiled the winner of the Great British Bake Off for me once. And I was like, really? My one joy, you know. And I'm not generally someone who especially cares about spoilers. I'm going to enjoy the story no matter what. You know, it's in the execution more than in the sort of reveal for me. There are some exceptions to that. For instance, you know, reality competition shows where I'm not so concerned about the execution. Yes. I've just gotten attached to these bakers. Yes. But the sort of extreme culture of like really hardcore responses to potentials. And the fact is that people are applying the spoiler label to things that are just objectively not spoilers. If you say like, oh, in this movie, a man who has just, you know, a man loses his wife and then he moves into a house. And there are people out there who will say, oh, well, him losing his wife is a spoiler. And I'm like, if you want to go in completely cold to any new movie, any new TV show, any new book, that is entirely your right to do that. But you can't go on the internet and then complain that people are talking about things. Like, I'm sorry. You just don't get to have it both ways.
Yes. Apologies to anybody who's not seen The Mothman Prophecies there that Emily spoilt for you.
Yeah.
Which bears no resemblance to the book and is, once again, one of those films that I hated when it came out. Now I really love it.
That's the case for a lot of people with that movie, I think.
Yeah. I was too hung up on the original book because I love John Keel.
Mm.
And so I was left feeling quite empty about the film. And I rewatched it 3 years ago and I've watched it about 6 times since. I love it now.
That's great.
It's a great film.
I need to revisit it, clearly, yeah.
It's grown on me a lot, Emily. It is one of those strange things. But I think this is one of those wonderful aspects about this particular genre, I think, that sometimes you can watch a film and not appreciate it the first time you see it, or perhaps you're not in the right frame of mind, or you're perhaps not even old enough sometimes, and maybe a lot of the ideas go over your head. And this period of that era, I've always found it odd that we kind of have two or three incredibly groundbreaking films in that early sort of 60s period. Psycho, Peeping Tom often gets mentioned by people like us, but I think the wider public go, what the hell are you talking about? It's a very strange and disturbing film that leaves you feeling unsettled. Obviously, it was horrifically treated by the zeitgeist at the time, and people made some horrific accusations towards the director and the scriptwriter and things. And it's one of those that I think its qualities have really come to show in a more modern era. I think it's one of those films where you could easily say it was way ahead of its time.
Yeah, and I think that's true of a lot of those movies. I mean, you know, think of Black Christmas, right?
Yes.
That one flies very much under the radar, unless you're someone who's kind of digging into like the history of slasher films. But you know, that's that kind of pioneering, like, okay, we're shooting these scenes from the killer's perspective, and the call is coming from inside the house, and all of that is like, oh, right, no, this stuff comes from somewhere. It doesn't just spring, you know, fully formed out of nowhere.
Yeah. I think sometimes one of the great things I like about horror films is often you can feel that you get homework, because sometimes you'll see ideas or themes that you think, where's that come from? What's that about? Where are you going? Like you say about Black Christmas. If you're really into your slashers, you understand it. It's one of those groundbreaking ones, whereas people always go, well, Halloween started the slasher genre. And you think, well, you need to go back a few years, I think, and start looking at what was going on slightly before that. Halloween certainly takes it to a different level as the early 80s video store choice will show you, that you couldn't move for serial killer slashers chasing young women around all parts of North America, it would seem, in that era.
Oh, you'd worry they'd run out of victims.
How many actresses are there left?
Right, there are only so many nubile young women.
Oh, and some hunky young men in certain films as well. Yeah, Jason didn't seem to be too particular about anybody's gender, really. He just wanted to kill them.
That's true. As I mean, you know, Michael did too. He pinned that guy to a cabinet in the first movie.
Well, yes, if you interrupt him while he's just probably going to prepare some eggs, I'd be angry too.
Exactly.
And then we seem to, for me, I think this is when horror sort of really sort of not grows up, but I think it starts being treated as a serious genre by critics, because you see Rosemary's Baby, Night of the Living Dead, and then you see the birth of folk horror, which I know you're a massive fan of as well.
Oh, yeah.
Emily, we're quite fortunate here in the UK, I think, because we put two of the greatest of that ilk out there for everybody, The Wicker Man and Blood and Satan's Claw.
Mm-hmm.
Both films disturb me in different ways. The Wicker Man is one of those films, I watched that completely cold. I didn't know anything about it other than Christopher Lee was in it. And I did not the last 20 minutes, I was just, my jaw was on the floor. I was like, no, they can't be. This can't be happening. And I love that sometimes when you get a film, even though you enjoy a particular genre, and you find something like that. I mean, it's, I don't know, 30, I must have seen it in my mid-teens. And it blew me away, even though at that point I was kind of more into sort of bright, lurid American horror films at that time. I think that the quality of that film is one of those, similarly to The Exorcist, that it didn't matter when you saw it at that particular era or age you were. Once you saw it, you never forgot it. And it often just burrows into your heart. And they're two of those that do that.
Yeah. And The Wicker Man, you know, aside from the remake that we don't speak of.
What remake?
I was something about bees. I don't know.
Oh, dear. Yes.
You know, it's decidedly underappreciated on this side of the Atlantic, which is a shame, because it is just so, I mean, there are really goofy elements of it. Yes. But even the friends who don't watch horror movies, I'll say, no, listen, we're going to sit down. We're going to watch The Wicker Man. You're going to be fine. Like, don't worry about it. You're going to have a great time. And they always do, because they're not expecting that level of sort of getting the rug pulled out from under you. at, you know, that late into the film, it's just delightful.
It is. And I think it's testament to everybody involved in it. There was a random documentary shown here because it was recently the anniversary, and the BBC dug out a sort of mini documentary they did from 98. I think it's celebrating the 25th anniversary, which was basically Edward Woodward just turning up where they'd filmed it, just hanging around and going to meet some of the extras who were all the locals in the pub and stuff, and just talking about how this film had changed his entire life, which is very odd for an actor of the caliber of Edward Woodward, which for people of a certain age, they would simply presume he was the original Equalizer. That's where a lot of people our era know him from. Whereas for him, he was a fine character actor with a long and distinguished career on stage and screen. And yet he thinks that The Wicker Man's one of the most important things he ever did in his life, which is remarkable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And Christopher Lee took it deadly seriously, too. I mean, he was instrumental in getting the movie distributed and getting it fun. I think he went without a salary just to make filming happen because they had no money. And he, you know, you can see that he's having a great time in that performance, because I mean, when was he not, right? He's just an all-timer. But you can also see how much it animated him, and I just think that's wonderful, and that really still comes across, what, 50 years later.
Yeah, I mean, he was often a man of impeccable decisions. I mean, the screen persona and the person in real life could not be more far apart. You know, he was a kind, generous, loving, supporting friend, father, husband. He was renowned for his intelligence and also his secret army past, because one of my favorite Christopher Lee stories is when they were filming Lord of the Rings and they were talking about stabbing somebody and the noise they would make. Lee just went, "Sorry, Peter, that's not the noise a man makes when he's dying after being stabbed." And I just thought, what? Christopher, tell me more, sir.
Yeah, he had some kind of covert ops. I don't know if it was SAS or something like that background, but he was a man who had seen some things.
Yeah. Well, it's often put forward as the inspiration for James Bond. I think he was certainly part of it. And I know it's one of the reasons why he ended up doing the Man with the Golden Gun as a favour to Fleming. So there's clearly something there, I think, Emily, in this wonderful past. But he was a very generous man. And famously the way he looked after Peter Cushing after Peter's wife died. I've forgotten the name. Well, they did a film almost immediately after she'd passed. And Lee just had him move in with him for 9 months to look
after
him.
That's wonderful. Yeah, every single story I've ever heard about him has been wonderful.
And so it's quite surprising, because Christopher Lee is one of those people who is, you can kind of attach him to several genres throughout the horror eras. Famously, he was Count Dracula. Famously, he turned down playing Dracula more than he actually performed him. I remember he turned down Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, which is a film that has a very soft spot in my heart because it's just barmy. But when he read the script and he said, "I'm not performing in this shit." And so they had to get a different Dracula, which disappointed Cushing because he'd signed on to play Van Helsing because he thought Lee was going to be Dracula again. but then he also made some very strange choices, because obviously he's in the Howling sequel, which is a very odd film. One of those, I remember it being advertised under its original title, which it's no longer called that, ironically. No. Which I didn't think it was acceptable in 1983, never mind in 2024, Emily.
Oh God, yeah. I mean, look, I'd rather have them change the title and have it still be available than, you know, have it just disappeared entirely.
Yes. I don't think it's too tied up in the film storyline, really. You know, you can call that film anything as long as it's got Howling 2 in it and it's not derogatory.
Right.
And so I suppose when you're having these challenges of that particular era, as I would imagine throughout this book, the biggest issue you would have, Emily, I would imagine, is arguing with yourself about, is your favorite film a film that needs to be in this book?
It was impossible. It was impossible. It was so hard to decide. I think when I started to do just kind of a brainstorm of, you know, what movies would I include, you know, no limits, just put it all on paper. It was like 50 movies. And there are 25 in the finished book. And yes. That was, some of them were very easy decisions. Ultimately, I was looking at influence more than, you know, ticket sales, you know, box office, anything like that, even word of mouth. But there were some movies where that it was very easy to cut. You know, I love The Descent so much. It is one of my favorite films. And I just thought, yeah, it's not influential enough.
Mm.
You don't see this. I was kind of looking for movies that had an effect on culture, had an effect on filmmaking. And, you know, there are some very easy wins in that category. I mean, Psycho, how many movies are responding to Psycho? How many movies are responding to Rosemary's Baby? How many movies are responding to Halloween or The Thing? There were some, and when I got right down to the wire, there were some cuts that were just emotionally devastating to me. Jaws, arguably my favorite movie of all time. And I thought it's right on that line. Like it's, you know, the kind of creature feature horror line is like, and I argued myself out of it and I still regret it. And the other one I regret arguing myself out of was Alien. I just don't know how I talked myself out of Alien, but I think it was just such a, like, there's no good choice for what to, you know, eliminate here. And there were a couple that I actually wrote full entries for that ended up getting cut. The Omen was one of them, which I had held on to until the bitter end because I love it. I love that movie. But ultimately, it wasn't influential in the same way that The Exorcist or Rosemary's Baby were in that kind of same vein. And I thought, all right, I got to cut. And I did ended up actually publishing that somewhere else as a kind of promo article for the book. So it lives on. But one that got cut at the very last minute was Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because I really can't stand that movie or that franchise.
Oh, thank God. Hallelujah.
There are literally dozens of us. But I, you know, my editor said, I can feel your disdain for this movie just like dripping off the page. Why don't we just get rid of it? I was like, great, fine by me.
Yes, I'm one of those people. There are lots of horror films I don't like, and most of them aren't mega successful franchises that seem to be unable to be killed off. That one just baffles me. I know Jason's a pretty cool character, but it's a bit like Michael Myers Light for me. And I think there are so many similarities, and you know that it was created so cynically.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I mean, I enjoy everybody involved in it. I think it's interesting. I love watching documentaries about things like this, but I must admit, I find it baffling. I think by the time you've got characters going into space, that's when a franchise needs to end. I'm sorry.
Right. You have quite literally lost the plot.
Yes. Unless it's Leprechaun, I'm saying no, Emily.
Right.
That's the only monster killer I want to see in space, I think.
Right. If you didn't start in a universe where going to space was an option, then I never want you to go to space.
No. It's up there with reboots. Just either don't do it or just leave it as it is. We don't mm-hmm. need to go all the way back to the beginning again. And so I suppose it's a challenge, really, I suppose, because as you say, you can kind of put an argument for both Halloween and Friday the 13th because they were so... For me, I think they're so enmeshed throughout the 80s with sequel after sequel after sequel of a variety of qualities, shall we say. Whereas Halloween, yes, it kind of loses its way a bit, but I think it's still got a better base level than the 13th franchise, yeah. I think.
Yeah, just the first movie is objectively a better film than the first Friday the 13th film.
Yes.
You know, it's undeniable. They are night and day. And, you know, Michael Myers. Well, I mean, that's the thing. There's Michael Myers and then Jason is not the killer in the first Friday the 13th movie. I mean, I think the most interesting thing about it is that the killer is a grieving middle-aged mother.
Yes.
But then they just drop that thread. And go and just are like, fine, fuck it, supernatural killer. And I just have no tolerance for it. You know, maybe if I had seen it initially at a different point in my life, but as it is, just does nothing for me.
Yeah, I think it is one of those. I think it's one of those films. If you see it at a certain age, it just burrows into you, and that's it. It's part of your psyche after that going forwards, I think. I mean, strangely enough, I preferred the series that they made in the 90s in Canada that's absolutely nothing to do with the Friday the 13th films, which is essentially like a supernatural version of The X-Files.
Tremendous. I love that.
And so it just shows you that, once again, they were just using the name. Even though it had absolutely, I can't even remember if they had like a hockey mask just in there for like a little nod and a wink. I don't think they were even that clever. It's a very strange, it's one of the strangest sort of spin-offs of something I've ever heard because they're not connected.
Yeah. Well, I do kind of miss that like lawless era of entertainment when people would just do stuff and you were like, why? Or how did you get away with this? Or, you know, what were you thinking? But like, you know, you don't get that anymore, maybe because it's so, I mean, if you do get it, you get it on like YouTube, you get it on the internet, you get it, you know, people shooting things with their friends on their phones.
Yes.
But those things don't get the same kind of, you know, you're not going to get distribution for anything like that anymore.
Yes. It's very doubtful we'll have a situation like Troll 2, perhaps.
Maybe that's for the best. I don't know.
Well, one scene never forgotten, Emily, for a variety of reasons. And so, like I said, I think these are the big challenges. I mean, Alien, I was quite surprised about, because I think for a lot of people, it's one of those few films. I mean, certainly at the time, it was a real outlier because horror films weren't set in space.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they don't have a strong female lead,
mm-hmm,
or an animal that doesn't get hurt in them.
Yeah.
And Alien turns all that on its head and completely rips the rule book up, to a point where it becomes so successful that I don't think they expected people to respond to it as positively as they did. And for, once again, for better or for worse, I think the first two films are outstanding for very different reasons. I think they're two very different films, but they're clearly very well connected. And Ripley's character, you can see the growth from the first to the second, which is remarkable to both directors and both screenwriters. I think that they kept that essence of her and didn't try and change it. If anything, Cameron ramps it up in the second one.
And I'm a longtime skeptic of James Cameron in a number of ways, but and surely you know the famous anecdote about his pitch for Aliens.
Yes.
Walks into a room, writes Alien on the whiteboard, looks at the executives, writes an S, puts a slash through it so it's a dollar sign. Room erupts. And take all the money you want, Jim. You're good.
Yes.
But that's the thing. The kind of the pat reductive answer is, okay, Alien is a horror movie. Aliens is a thriller. And I think that's largely true. But I also think that, and I like Aliens. I like Aliens a lot. But I think if you look at the ups and downs of that particular franchise over the years, especially with most recently with Alien Romulus, which is a movie I liked that I thought had some very strong flaws. But I think this idea of, oh, if we just keep throwing a ton of xenomorphs at these characters, that's what the people want, right? And it's like, well, kind of. But I also want interesting, tense, like locked room spaceship, you know, horror stories like the first one, even like the third one, which is a very flawed movie.
Yes.
But it at least does interesting and original things.
Mm. Yeah, I think as with anything, it's the law of diminishing returns, I have to say.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people that if you push me, I'll say there are four Alien films. I don't recognize anything that's happened in the last 15 years.
Yeah, no, that's totally fair.
And I say that as a man that sat through Alien versus Predator and laughed. For most,
I mean, what
of
else
it.
Can you do? Yeah.
Exactly. Like, what the hell am I doing with my life?
Well, when Romulus came out, I rewatched Prometheus, which is, why did I do that? I think that movie, there is exactly one perfect set piece in that movie, and it's when she gets in the pod and is trying to get it to like basically abort the xenomorph inside of her. And she's desperately trying to beat the clock. And it is one of the most just like skin shreddingly tense pieces of filmmaking in the middle of this ridiculous ridiculous movie otherwise that has really nothing to, you know, redeem it except for that one scene. And that's one of those like, okay, yeah, I mean, the shine is still there. It just, you know, nobody knows how to use it, I think.
Yes. Yeah, very true. And once again, I'm exactly the same. I was infuriated with that film. I was like, if my friend turns up outside the spaceship and he's now folded up like a deck chair, I'm not opening that door. Because when my friend left, he didn't look like that.
No.
Oh, let's let Brian in. It's fine. I'm sure there's nothing wrong here. Yeah. I mean, no.
It's you're familiar with the concept of the idiot ball? Yeah, that's for any listeners who aren't, it's the kind of screenwriting conceit of, oh yeah, you know, we need this character to do this thing, but we don't have a good reason for him to do this thing. Well, he's holding the idiot ball, so we're just going to make him do it anyway. And that's just a whole fit. Like, it's a ball pit. It's an idiot ball pit. That yeah. film is what it is.
Yes. Well, there's lots of them about. I remember seeing recently a British werewolf film called Howl, Emily, which is brilliant until somebody picks up the idiot ball. And then the last 20 minutes is just like, oh no.
Yeah. And I'm a forgiving viewer, I will say. I'm generally like, oh yeah, that's a plot hole, but like I'm enjoying the rest of it. I don't really care. Like, I'm not someone who's picking for inconsistencies generally, but there is a line, right? You have to keep me in it at least at a baseline level, and that movie did not.
And it is, as I say, I think horror, space horror, is quite, Alien is one of those films that kind of stands out, especially in that era, as being completely on its own, essentially. I mean, you might have a few science fiction films that were quite frightening, but not necessarily to be a horror film, which essentially Alien is a serial killer who just happens to be a xenomorph, really. But you kind of see it maturing as we've gone, and nowadays it's not that rare to get one. I still find it odd that people say, oh, well, horror films can't be set in space, which I find ridiculous when we've had films like the Alien franchise, and we've got Event Horizon is another prime example.
Oh, I love that movie.
You could say there's a bit of that going on in Prince of Darkness, because we're talking interdimensional transportation and scientific ideas that aren't really part of horror's DNA in 1987. So it's,
yeah.
But there's more and more of them that happen. And I think if you've got the concept and you've got a good enough script, you can set a horror film anywhere, really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the setting is, if you're doing it right, the setting should be part of it, but not integral to what you're doing. I mean, sometimes it is for, you know, peripheral plot reasons. You know, the thing is effective because they're in the middle of nowhere in Antarctica, right? And the stakes are, how do we prevent this from getting to the rest of the human population? So, okay, there they need to be out in the middle of nowhere, but they could have been on a ship in the ocean. They could have been in the middle of the Sahara, right? The plot is the thing, and the setting should influence it, and they should influence each other. But I don't think it can be the only thing. You can't hang a whole movie, a whole novel, just on setting.
Yeah, because sometimes you end up having to make strange decisions. I mean, the thing, not that I'm surprised, because as you were saying, I think along with Jaws, it for me chops and changes which one I love the most depending on what day of the week it is, Emily, I think. And The Thing is one of them that I have grown to really like it, to think it's brilliant, to now consider it part of my own DNA, I think. I love it from top to bottom, back to front, left to right, any which way you want to throw it at me. I adore it now. I think it's Carpenter's best film by a long way. And it's one of those films that I don't understand why that didn't hit, along with Blade Runner, because 1982 is a strange year.
It is a strange year.
Because for me, they're two of the smartest, sharpest, cleverest films of that era. Both come out in the same year. Both don't find an audience for whatever reason. I'm not going to insult cinema goers, because a lot of people who enjoy film are very clever, are well read, do enjoy these subjects. I don't understand why neither of them bombed. But I'm old enough to remember, probably more so Blade Runner, having a cultural sort of reevaluation a lot quicker than The Thing did. The Thing seems to pick up sort of mid to late 90s, whereas I think by the beginning of the 90s, people were saying, actually, Blade Runner's a classic, and we were all wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Stone cold masterpiece. And I haven't seen that happen. I've seen it happen a little bit, you know, with more recent films, but not as often as I'd like. You know, there are movies that I'll that everyone else hated that I'll just die on the hill. Alex Garland's Men is actually one of them. I think I might be the only person in the world who liked that movie. but, you know, we see these kind of reappraisals. I think, what were you talking about earlier? The Mothman prophecies. Yes. Right, right. You know, we do have these, but again, I was talking about this with someone last night. You know, we're kind of the monoculture is not a thing anymore, right? So cultural opinion was never one thing, but we've kind of fractured out, you know, everyone kind of does their special interest. Mm. So when there is a critical reappraisal, it might be a critical reappraisal among a group of horror fans who all talk to each other on a particular social media platform. It's not often that it's more broad than that. But I do kind of miss those days. You know, I miss that sort of like, oh, that movie we all thought was crap. Actually, it's pretty great.
I'm not sure why that happens. It's almost as if sometimes films get lost and then rediscovered. It seems far more in the sort of old physical age of owning films or renting them. And maybe they get on syndicated TV and that sort of develops traction for it. I mean, The Wizard of Oz is probably the best example of that. It didn't have the level of addiction that its audience has now until it was sort of syndicated on TV several times.
The Shawshank Redemption. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That, I mean, because my entire association with that movie, which I have seen easily, 20 times, largely because it was always on the movie channel we had growing up. And then I learned later, like, oh, this was not, you know, considered good when it came out. And, you know, now it's just kind of unimaginable to think that.
Mm. It's sometimes surprising. I mean, I know at the minute, The Keep is about to be finally released from wherever Michael Mann has kept it hidden from the world for the best part of 40 years. And I remember seeing that on a very dodgy pirate in the mid 80s, and it made no sense to me at all because I didn't understand it had been cut to ribbons. I thought, what the hell is this? What's going on? Where's Scott Glenn come from? I thought these were Nazis. He's an alien? What? I'm no confused. What, he's now making love to this woman? What is happening here? I thought they were sister and brother. I'm really confused. And so I'm quite excited to see it sort of put back together, I hope. But also, I saw it recently. I saw the most sort of available version about 10 years ago. And it's one of those that you can tell there's a really good film there. You're not really sure what's happening.
Yeah, that editing things into just incoherence is something that I am glad we've more or less left in the past. Although I will say, you know, I watched the Salem's Lot adaptation that came out this year, and that is a movie that was very clearly hacked away at by a number of different people while it sat on the shelf for a few years, which is a shame because I also think there was a good movie in there initially, but they took away so much of the connective tissue that makes that story work.
Yes.
That there was nothing left holding it together. Mm. You know, I to go back to The Wicker Man, I think when people kind of go, oh, well, it's silly. Well, you know, a lot of that is these weird editing choices that used to be made, especially when something was shipped from one country to another, and like, well, American audiences aren't going to look that, so we'll just, you know, slash and burn. I'm glad that mostly doesn't happen anymore. You know, there are certainly other issues. We want to air this in China, so we can't have any gay characters or whatever, you know.
Yes.
But I think those lost versions of movies are something that kind of, or like, you know, the lost footage of Event Horizon, right? Mm-hmm. Something that haunts me, something that we're just never going to see, but oh God, I wish we could.
I mean, that's surprising as well because of who made it, who's in it, and when it was released, and the fact it was a success at the time. Mm-hmm. You would think that the studio would be chomping at the bit to go, oh, by the way, we found this 20 minutes and now we've got the super extended version that you can all watch again and pay us lots of money for.
Yeah, I would love to. But, you know, I don't make the rules, unfortunately. Yeah, I should. I'm just saying.
I imagine as well that probably wading through the 80s was quite difficult, Emily. Because
oh my God, yeah.
That's obviously when it all explodes, I think, culturally, due to video. It's everywhere. And like we're joking about how many sequels. You had franchise pop up at the beginning of the 80s, and by 1988, you're like, what, why are we at number five here? How who's watching this? What is going on? And then you get others. I mean, there are some that I just love because they're just daft, like Puppet Master.
Mm-hmm.
Because why one of the characters carries a stuffed Yorkshire Terrier through the film is never explained at all whatsoever. And you've got like the crap psychic and just really weird little people running about killing everyone. But I ended up really, really, really falling in love with these weird puppets. And I think the third one's just wonderfully balmy. Like
yeah.
Puppets killing Nazis. Why not? But you have others that sort of, for you, when you look at it, when you see some of these films, is it surprising that some of them don't hit and they end up still remaining cults, like Puppet Master, like Phantasm, when you have entries in those particular franchises, like Phantasm 2, is an incredible film. I mean, it does seem like there are two films being shown at the same time, strangely, but it's also one of those, like Evil Dead and Evil Dead 2, that Phantasm 2 is essentially a big budget remake of the first one with a few tweaks here and there. Mm-hmm. It seems very similar. And yet Phantasm is one of those that those of us that love those weird balls flying around and the tall man, we seem to be quite rare. Whereas, as you said earlier on, Friday the 13th, people love those films, despite the fact that most of them are rubbish.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, the alchemy of what makes something a hit and something else a flop is, I've spent much of my career working in book publishing, and this is something that, you know, people are just, like, if I knew, I'd be a trillionaire. But there's some, you know, it's a combination of the creator, the cast, the aesthetic, the studio support is, you know, obviously if they decide something's no good, then, you know, all hope is lost. I think about the movie The Empty Man. That's it.
Oh, I don't know that.
No, there's no reason you would. It is a bizarre movie directed by someone I'd never heard of. No big name actors. And it's basically about a sort of a being from the Himalayas that sort of starts stalking this man in the US, and it's weird and shaggy, and it very clearly dumped onto streaming in 2020, and I started hearing about it from people who were, you know, picking up on it, and I watched it and I was like, this very clearly needed at least one more edit pass to make it sort of make sense and cohere, but the studio obviously decided they didn't want to spend any more time and money on it. But there's some like really good stuff in that movie. The whole, like, the title doesn't drop until like 20 minutes in, and the entire opening sequence takes place in this like cabin in the Himalayas, and it is chilling. Really good, really weird. And it's one of those that I think if they had given it support, if they had if it had come out at a different time, too. I mean, obviously, 2020 was not a great year for anything to be released. If it had been given support and resources, especially if we look at the amount of money that studios spend on things like the marketing for the Wicked movie, you know, that came out this year, the marketing budget for that must have been, I don't even know, just the tie-ins they were doing, the weird promos they were doing. And it's kind of like, well, if they want to, they will, right?
Hmm.
But movies like that, they sometimes just get dumped with no support. And you're like, this could have been it, right?
Hmm.
Maybe it wouldn't have, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know is the answer. I wish I did. But I think it's just a weird serendipitous happenstance when, you know, one thing hits and another doesn't.
Hmm. Especially a film like Wicked, because for me, you don't need to spend £300 million promoting one of the most successful musicals of all time as a prequel to one of the most beloved children's films of all time.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes no sense. If any film was going to be a success, it would have been Wicked this year, without question. Regardless of who's in it or anything, you've got that ground base of love for it that those people would go and go and go, as they have done with the musical.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that kind of money, it's like, oh, what else could we have done with it, right?
You but then on the other to the empty man.
Right. But then on the other side of things, you know, my mom used to sell books as a sales rep in the 80s. And she would go to her bookstore accounts and she would say, you know, I have another Garfield anthology, right? The Garfield comics. And the buyers would kind of go, oh, these again, you know, and she's like, yeah, I know. But that money lets us print, you know, the debut novel that's never going to make its advance back. You know, that's the money that funds the other stuff. It's like, well, OK, what could the Wicked marketing money have funded?
Yeah, exactly. I think sometimes you've got to take the rough with the smooth and things like that does allow, especially publishing companies, it allows them to have a bit of a freer range and take a risk on something that if they were financially constrained, they would possibly have to pass up and we'd all miss out.
Mm hmm. Mm-hmm.
I suppose as well, for me, I think there's one author over the last sort of 15 years who I think has kind of come in to the horror genre completely from left field, going on his relationships and who his father and mother were, that I would never have suggested that Max Brooks would write two of the best horror fiction books that I personally love. World War Z, I think is probably the best fiction book I've read this century.
It's wonderful.
Because I didn't expect anything. I'd read his survival guide and really liked it. I thought it was clever and it was funny in the way it was kind of saying that these historical events weren't really disasters, they were zombie outbreaks. And once you buy into that philosophy of it, the whole world changes inside the pages of his book. And so World War Z is one of those that I'm still not comfortable with watching the film again. I have to say.
No.
Because I always say, if the zombies in a zombie film are not the most outlandish scene in the film, you're in trouble. And there's two scenes in that film which are like, what? And we've got zombies as well? No.
Yeah.
No, I'm not having that. But obviously, when he released his Bigfoot book,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm obsessed with big hairy creatures living in the woods, Emily. That, I just loved Evolution. I thought it was really clever. I could also see exactly what was going to happen.
Yeah.
Because I know enough about Bigfoot. And it was clear that he'd done his research and worked on it. And I know that they've sold the rights. I'm not sure who's going to be directing it or if Max is doing the screenplay for it. But we're going to get a Devolution film in the next couple of years, which I'm very excited about, because good Bigfoot films, you can count on one hairy foot.
Yes. No, that's fair. I was having this conversation with somebody recently and they were like, are there any good cryptid movies? And I was like, I mean, we can dig up a couple, but I don't know. And yeah, I really liked Devolution as well. I had a lot of fun reading it. He's got that gift of being an incredibly accessible and engaging writer. Mm. And World War Z, I've read twice. One of my all time favorites. I just love the format so much. I think it's brilliant. The movie, we don't need to. It didn't happen. Someday I hope that we will get the mini series adaptation that book deserves.
Yes.
But this was certainly not it.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those. I think for me, it's akin to The Watchmen. I think it's one of those properties that is essentially unfilmable because it's so rich and it's so layered. And the way it's written, for me, it would be very difficult to make that a functioning film. It's too big, I think.
I think mini, it's a mini series or it's nothing. I think you cannot make it a, you know, two and a half hour movie. You're just, as with Salem's Lot, you're just going to lose too much.
Yes. I mean, obviously, I mean, as often happens in this kind of situation, I've got to know the author, Luke Phillips, and he released his Bigfoot book, Rogue, at the beginning of this year, which is phenomenal. And he's also got one of those wonderful twists that you never see coming. And you think, how on earth are these people going to deal with this unstoppable creature? Oh, I know what. We'll have some Native American spellcasting pulling something else into our world. And if you've never read it, it is an amazing book.
I have not, but I will look it up. Yeah. There's also a great one that came out this year. Allie Russell is the author, and it is a middle grade book. So it's a book for, you know, 10-year-olds. Mm. But it's set in the Massachusetts woods, and a little girl who's camping with her kind of Girl Scout troop her best friend is abducted by something large and hairy and smelly and terrifying in the night. And nobody will believe her. Oh. You know, they think it's been like a snatching or the girl ran away.
Yeah.
So she joins another Girl Scout troop to go to a camping trip to the same area to see if she can find her friend. And it's delightful. It's just, I had a great time reading it. It's called It Came from the Trees.
Ah, brilliant. Oh, I'll keep my eye out for that. I'll keep my eye out for that. I suppose as well, with you having a foot in both camps, as you mentioned about Salem's Lot, as you said, we went to see the latest version because it got a very limited cinema release here in the UK. And it's always been probably my favourite King book, I think. I just love it. Primarily because Barlow scares me so much, I think.
Yeah.
And there's that brooding domino effect going on where people are just disappearing and everybody's like, oh, Steve's
right,
not
the
around
town
anymore.
Is just emptying out gradually. It's so effective.
Yeah. And so he's always one of those where you're not really sure how true or how good an adaptation we're going to get. Occasionally, we might get a Shawshank or a Misery, or we might get numerous versions of Salem's Lot. I think they've had three goes at it. They've changed it dramatically every time.
Yeah.
It, you know, the original looks when it was made, the one that came out 15 years ago, nobody seems to want to talk about that one. And this one seems to have been stuck in editing hell for 3 years, which I found really odd because of who's in it. And I think the surprising thing about why Salem's Lot was stuck on a shelf for 3 years is that Lewis Pullman's career seems to have really taken off during the interim period, Emily, especially because he was on Open Range, which has had two seasons on Prime, which a lot of people really liked. He's now joined the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Mm-hmm. He's a man on the way up. And you would think it's a very odd decision when someone's career is clearly picking up to leave that on a shelf for 3 years and then butcher an hour out of it, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
Originally, it was nearly 3 hours long, wasn't it?
Yeah. And they really just kind of went at it with a hatchet in a way that I found really dispiriting, because it looked good. Like, the visuals were really good. I thought there were some good scares in it. I thought there were some good performances. I loved Bill Camp as the teacher. I'm
yes.
always happy to see him. I you know, I thought, oh, if this were better, I could do something with, I don't know, Bill Camp Kill Vamp. But, but I was just so disappointed by it. And the decision to relocate that whole final fight scene to the drive-in was bizarre to me.
Mm.
Like, why would these vampires all be sleeping in car trunks at the drive-in? I don't know. I found it, I could go on about it for ages, but just a lead balloon is how it went over for me.
Yeah. It's one of those where somebody goes, wouldn't it be good if this happens? I know what, let's change the entire ending to make that happen. Because why would you sleep in a car when you live there?
Right.
You just sleep in your own basement, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I'm like, you know, if I'm stretching my imagination, I'm like, okay, maybe I guess they're coffin-like, but like, that's never addressed. I don't know. It just makes no sense. Like, I should not be the one doing mental gymnastics trying to make this work.
Yes. It was very surprising. I know when we came out, my partner said to me, and she really wanted to go to see it. And she said after about 30 minutes, I was about to ask you if you wanted to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And we stuck it out because I don't tend to walk out ever.
Yeah.
Because you never know. But there weren't many people in the showing. And four people got up after about 40 minutes and went, which
yeah.
I thought, blimey. You've got high standards, because I've seen a lot worse than this. I know it's not perfect and it's not the story I love, but
yeah,
there are worse things. And so King is one of those that, like I say, with this, you just never know what you're going to get. So is it difficult when you're pulling a book together like that not to go for one of those sort of well-known ones? I mean, obviously, Carrie, for me, I think is one of the best adaptations. Once again, it seems so unusual in the era it comes out, because it's predominantly a female driven film talking about female issues and female situations and a very damaged family unit with a cataclysmic ending where you end up going, yes, I hope she kills everybody, go.
Yeah, a woman pushed too far. Yeah. I mean, the Stephen King of it all is let's see, in the book, I've got Carrie and I've got The Shining. And those were the two. Again, I was just going purely, you know, okay, influence was like the guiding factor. And there have been other notable King adaptations, of course. I mean, look at, you know, Misery, Shawshank Redemption, as we were talking about. I mean, I would even throw Cujo in the mix. I love that movie.
yes.
But there are also a lot of bad Stephen King adaptations. I mean, like, where to even start? I would say that Dark Tower adaptation from a few years ago was oof. And I'm like, this is controversial as well, but I'm not a huge Mike Flanagan fan personally. So I'm a little like, okay, fine. This is going to become his sandbox any minute now. And I don't know well what the results are going to be. Mm. But I thought, you know, this whole book could just be Stephen King adaptations. But I thought that about so many things. I was like, this whole book could just be movies since the year 2000. This whole book could just be movies from the 60s and 70s and 80s. Hell, this whole movie could be on slashers. This whole movie could be on haunted houses. This whole movie could be on zombies and other monsters. So I really had to kind of just like keep my focus to, okay, influence. And those were really the two King movies that stand out. But with books, with the book world, my line has always kind of been, you know, nobody needs my help to find Stephen King. You know, they might need my help to find, I don't know, Aaron E. Adams or T. Kingfisher or Clay McLeod Chapman or you know, probably not Paul Tremblay and Stephen Graham Jones at this point. But there are a lot of horror authors out there who need the boost a lot more than Uncle Steve.
Yes. I mean, for me, obviously, is the American version. I mean, for one of my favourite horror authors was obviously the legendary James Herbert here in the UK, who I still say has never had a decent film made out of any of his work. I know he's got four books talking about mutant rats, but he's also got some very strange ghost stories going on in there. And it's a real shame that we lost him when we did, because he just got out of writer's block that had held him up for 10 years. He releases a book and then he passed away about 6 months afterwards, and that was that. Because as a teenager growing up, I was obsessed with his books, The Rat's Lair, The Main, Moon, The Haunted Cottage, because they were like nothing I'd ever read before. Moon especially is one of those wonderful books where you get to the end and you realise that it's not a person you've been falling for, it's actually a ghost. Yeah. And everybody else in it is human. They're the ghost. And you're like, what? And when you're 14, you're like, this has just blown my mind. I have no idea how I've not seen this coming. And so some of these authors, I think, don't get that kind of an adaptation where really poorly executed franchises or generic slashers or torture porn or all these kind of really easy to throw together and just throw at the screen films that come out and kind of tarnish some of the better aspects of this particular series of films, I find sometimes frustrating. Is it surprising to you, like I say, with you having a foot in both camps, that there are very successful horror authors who have never made that jump for whatever reason? Studios just don't seem to want them.
You know, I don't know. There are authors who I desperately wish we would get adaptations of. And then there are authors where, you know, they get an adaptation. And I'm like, ooh, maybe I should have been careful what I wished for there. Like, I love Paul Tremblay's work. I think he's a wonderful, smart, incisive, mean writer. And I mean that in a complimentary way.
Yes.
You know, and the adaptation of A Cabin at the End of the World is just, it just guts what makes the book interesting to me. And I would almost rather have not seen it. But at the same time, I would do almost anything for a good adaptation of A Head Full of Ghosts.
Yes.
You know, I think any of Stephen Graham Jones's books would be, I don't know, that's a little tricky to me because he's so brilliant, but a lot of it is his voice. His voice is so distinctive. And his point of view, I mean, The Jade Daniels books, the Indian Lake trilogy, are so self-referential and layered that it's like, I don't know how you'd do that justice. You know, the adaptation of Bird Box is just a fundamentally different. I mean, that's a movie that a successful adaptation, in my mind, it would have to get like really weird and experimental.
Yes.
In a way that, you know, the Netflix adaptation was just never going to be able to get there. I think there are, I mean, I want, so, you know, Manhunt by Gretchen Felker Martin, one of my favorite books the last 5 years, that's currently getting shopped as a TV show adaptation. And, you know, I know Gretchen, I know, you know, kind of who she's got involved in the process. I'm like, okay, if that happens, it's going to be really good, I think. But because the writer has ultimately so little power that I kind of, I don't know, I hesitate to wish that on people sometimes.
I suppose as well with this book, you've really sort of, what I love about this is that you've got these wonderful sort of research projects for every film that you've put forward to us. And you tell them, well, if you like this, you're probably going to like that. So you've basically combined your love of horror film with horror literature, which I think is marvelous, as well as a few sort of trivia points and clearing things up, like the amount of times that I get really annoyed when people say, oh, well, Psycho's based on Ed Gein. No, it wasn't.
Nope.
Right? It just happened at the same time. Mm-hmm. And like you mentioned, Block just stuck a line in when it came back for editing. And that stuck with it ever since. It's a throwaway line in, I don't know, 270 pages. And right. Yet people go, oh, it's all about Ed Gein. Well, it's not. and so when you, as you say, he often gets put forward as the expert, as the reason for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, even though it's completely dissimilar to anything Gein was doing, other than the fact that one of them seems to be wearing a mask made of human skin. That's about the only connection.
I think it's the aesthetics of the house, too, you know, with all of the decorations made out of bones and tan skin, I think is really where that comes into play. It's less about, you know, the characters or the actual events. It's just like, oh, we borrowed some disturbing imagery, you know.
So I suppose as we sum it up, Emily, with this book out there, has it given you an appetite to do a second volume? Like you say, that you can now include Jaws and Alien and give us the next 25? Or is it something that you think you'd like to focus more on horror literature and promoting some of these wonderful authors that you've mentioned during our conversation?
Well, it is going to be a series, but it's not going to be a series on the same topic, and it's not going to be a series written by the same person. Quirk, my wonderful publisher, we're kind of positioning this as the first book in the Outsider's Guide series. The idea being it's explanations of pop culture phenomena that, you know, are written to be accessible for people who are not fans of those. So I believe one of the future installations is going to be on reality TV. I think they've been talking about, you know, maybe romantic comedies. And they'll all be written by kind of subject matter experts in those topics.
Yeah.
It would be a lot of fun to do a second volume of this, but I am focusing a little bit more on fiction right now, horror fiction. Right now, very specifically at the end of the year, I'm doing, as I have for the past 5 years, most of my focus is on getting up my new release horror fiction list, which I do on my website, which is readjumpscares.com. And every year since 2020, I have maintained a running list of every new horror book that's coming out. And it gets updated at least monthly.
Yeah.
And it's I do it just because it's a resource that I needed. And so I couldn't find it anywhere. I decided to make it myself. And now I hear from people all the time, you know, oh, this is great. I use this to order books for the library where I work, or I use this to plan out my coverage because I'm a reviewer or a, you know, a bookstagrammer or something like that. You know, I've had booksellers tell me it's how they plan what they want to buy for the year, which is amazing. And so that takes, as you might imagine, that's a fair amount of work.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, at this list for 2025 that I just published has over 300 titles on it already.
Mm.
So that's what I've been working on most recently. And then I think once I get through the holidays, it's time to double down on the novel I've been promising to write for several years now.
Well, I want to thank you for your conversation. Thank you for such a wonderful book. Like I say, not only is it deeply insightful, it's whip smart funny. It's full of wonderful little nuggets of knowledge, which I always... I like to read a book that makes me cleverer than when I started. And this is certainly one of those. Emily, where can everybody get a copy of this and also follow your work online? Because I know you do numerous articles for various publications all around the world.
Oh, thank you so much. The book, you should be able to get... I'm not as clear on how this works in the UK, although I do know it's available for sale at certain bookstores. You should be able to get it from any online book retailer. You should be able to get it, hopefully, in your local shop. And then elsewhere, you can find me. I'm no longer on Twitter / whatever they're calling it now. I am, however, on Blue Sky at emilyhughes.bsky.social, on Instagram at emchughes17. And again, my website is readjumpscares.com. That's kind of my central location. I do write reviews. I write lists and other coverage. I write for the New York Times. I write for Reactor Magazine, Vulture, Thrillist, and any number of other outlets.
Well, I'll make sure I put links to everything as much as I can, with your wide range of coverage. And I just want to say thank you again for both your conversation today, your company, and also thank you for a wonderful addition to any horror lover's library, and one we can try and sneak into as many Christmas stockings as possible for those scaredy cats desperate to join us.
Thank you so much, Paul. This was a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate you having me on.